The White Pill is available now at whitepillbook.com. This episode is brought to you by Patriot Gold.
I think it's naive for individual citizens to think that they can go up against the state in the face of, let's say, injustice and think that they can come out okay.
Good afternoon, Michael Malice here. Let that be your welcome for the next hour. We have with us a very long-awaited, very special guest, Andy Ngo. Andy is editor-at-large at the Postmillennial. His last book, Unmasked, let me get the exact subtitle right, Unmasked Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy, was a New York Times bestseller despite the New York Times' best efforts to squash it and despite Powell Books refusing to stock it. Andy, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the show.
It's an honor. Thank you so much, Michael, for the invitation to come on and speak with you. I thought I'd wear this hat just in as a thank you to the kind people that I met in Texas when I was in Austin recently.
Oh, you were here? When were you here for the Minds Festival or something?
I wasn't. It was just I was visiting a friend, and so she told me about how amazing Buc-ee's is, and
yes,
I had no idea what that was. Yes, it took my breath away, and I had to buy a memento. So,
We took a road trip to Dallas for my birthday, and one of the guys in the car was like, "We got to stop at Buc-ee's," and I thought, "All right, you know, my New York too cool for school." And then I went there and I'm like, I am not cool enough for this school. For those who don't know, Buc-ee's is like an experience. It's ostensibly like a convenience store, but you've got a huge selection of like jams and jellies. There's snacks. There's all the fridges are full. There's a sandwich shop. There's a bakery. There's t-shirts. It's all really clean, very affordable, and it's got a cool logo. So I absolutely became a Buc-ee's convert on the spot. It's just also what makes it really fun if you're taking a long trip. Is it's a great way to spend like a half an hour instead of it being like, all right, we're just going to get a snack and go to the bathroom. You can go there and have a fun experience. So I completely endorse Buc-ee's and I'm not getting paid to do so. But it's a great aspect of being here in Texas. So Andy, one of the things that you're most famous of is your famously, I don't know if I describe it as hostile relationship between you and Antifa. A lot of people don't even know what Antifa is. As President Biden had once claimed, Antifa is an idea. I'd like to hear you explain from your experience and your perspective, just what is Antifa?
So when Biden said that infamously at one of the presidential debates in 2020, he's not actually wrong in saying that, but it's incomplete. So you can think of Antifa, it's short for anti-fascism, and it's that name itself is meant to deceive people. But putting that aside, it's ideology. It's a movement of decentralized groups, cells, and individuals of radicalized far-left extremists. They say they're fighting fascism. They say they're anarchists. Some of them say they're communists. Some of them say they're a fusion of both. And they believe that their agenda is to fight fascism wherever it manifests, particularly through the use of criminal means such as violence, intimidation, harassment, and doxing. And by doxing, I refer to releasing people's personal addresses, their phone numbers, other information where bad actors can actually do actual harm to individuals and their families. They do all this. I'm sure your audience has seen now years of the videos of the riots, the attacks, the crowbar attacks, the mace, the bike locks, et cetera, et cetera. They use a lot of these sort of low-level violent stuff, and they do escalate at times to deadly violence, such as when a self-described Antifa member shot dead a Trump supporter in Portland in 2020. So, you know, They have to organize an opposition to something. It was really easy to, in terms of a propaganda messaging standpoint, to do that when Trump was had won the election in 2016 and 4 years of him in office, because they had the mainstream media repeating the lies day in and day out. America elected a fascist. We are under a fascist regime. People need to resist. Hashtag resist. So they had the mainstream media doing their messaging for them, which is why they were particularly effective. And now with Trump out of office, you probably have noticed we're seeing a bit less of them. And their what who they're describing as fascists now has to really expand, because the big bad orange man is no longer in office. You're not really seeing MAGA rallies that much anymore. So who do they target now? They target people who are evangelical Christians, pro-life people, women's rights activists, you know. So we're seeing in the past 2 years now a lot of Antifa mobilization around drag queen events. They're styling themselves as sort of a militia to protect these events. You've seen them attack, vandalize, and destroy various pregnancy resource centers and even churches. If the listeners are having a difficult time, like, kind of drawing a consistent thread in the ideology, that I'm glad they have that observation. There isn't really a lot of coherence to the ideology. It's more so, I mean, they have their texts where they reference a lot of anarchist thinkers from the 20th century, but really the reality is all that stuff is kind of irrelevant. It attracts people who are extreme and who are prone to violence and get a thrill out of being sort of in a street gang and engaging in violence against somebody on the other side and having comrades, essentially fellow gang members, to back them up when they engage in mob violence.
But would you, let's just take a step back. Do you think there's any place for violence in political discourse in this country?
No, I think the success of liberal democracies and Western societies, developed societies, is that we don't normalize or have a norm of political violence. Obviously, there are historical examples of where that's not the case. But I think discourse in civilized societies is how we're able to resolve conflict, right? Antifa view all this as antithetical to their agenda, which is why they explicitly use force and violence to shut down discussion. That's very important to their MO, is silencing people by any means necessary. So they believe, for example, that a Holocaust could have been stopped, would be a future Holocaust can be stopped if you nip any far-right ideology in the bud. And by that, they mean going after people for expressing speech that they view can lead somewhere down the line to fascism. Of course, all of this is nonsense. So a lot of times the people they go after are not actual far-right neo-Nazis, which do exist in America in small numbers, but they do exist. They go after people, the low-hanging fruit, the people, the low-hanging target, I mean. So somebody with a Trump flag, somebody who expresses views critical of medical transitioning of children, people who speak up for women's rights, et cetera, et cetera.
But I mean, wasn't America founded on political violence?
Yes, but I think we have to be really careful that we don't. What Antifa do is they do incorporate a lot of historical events as sort of into their mythos. So they'll point to various, let's say, anarchist assassinations in Europe in the 20th century that sparked revolutions or attempted revolutions, uprisings, and say, look, there's an example, there's precedent for how wh why our use of violence can really be used for something good, something better. Their ultimate goal is revolution. They believe that the American imperialist capitalist system needs to be overthrown. And so anything they can use to sort of as propaganda to incite violence and uprisings, they will use. BLM's messaging has been particularly effective for them. It's really easy, for example, to point to instances like George Floyd and Michael Brown or others and say, look, the police are the instrument of the state. The state is systematically racist against Black and Brown people. They're armed. They're out there specifically with the goal to kill people of color, trans people, etc. And therefore, when we engage in violence, it's not actually really violence. It's self-defense. I'm repeating their lies and propaganda here. So, you know, I understand what your point is when you're saying, well, look, there are examples of political violence being so embedded in part of American history and American tradition. Yes, but that really, from my perspective and views, it's in a historical context, really different from norms and laws that are established today for the rules of engagement regarding politics.
But I think, and I'm not approaching this from a Antifa perspective, but just taking kind of a more bird's eye view, when those laws are used to enforce violence on the population, it falls on the population to enforce security and protection. I'm thinking specifically of Kyle Rittenhouse. When the police were ordered to stand down, they refused to do anything while BLM were rioting out of control. And when Kyle Rittenhouse tried to do his part to kind of keep the peace, he was the one who went to jail for it. And in fact, when Kyle Rittenhouse went to the police after he shot those three men and tried to turn himself in, rather than even talk to him, the cops pepper sprayed him. So my question to you and the New York City subway system, I forgot the guy who just recently died. He went to jail. Jordan Neely, thank you. He went to jail for 4 months because he had dragged a 7-year-old in a kidnapping attempt. And I don't see I just want to be careful because we're on YouTube. If the police and the legal system are refusing to put this person behind bars and they're painfully aware that he's a threat, he made their top 50 list, doesn't it fall on the citizenry to enforce social norms in those circumstances?
Well, certainly I'm not going to make, advocate for that type of direct action. I think it's better really to keep my personal opinion out. It's more so I observe than I report. However, to your point, I think, let's say, the examples you just brought up, many people, let's say, who feel very passionate about, actually on either side, but let's say the conservative or right-wing perspective, which is that Kyle Rittenhouse was defending a community that he lived in or spent a lot of time in,
yep.
in the context of riots going on where police were not intervening as businesses were literally set on fire and destroyed. The former Marine who's accused of manslaughter of Jordan Neely in New York City was intervening because this homeless man with a history of violent criminality and attacks on people was being threatening and potentially extremely dangerous to people in an enclosed space. In all these examples, people who have done what they thought was morally the right thing in the absence of the enforcement of the law, have or are facing the full weight of the prosecutions on them. So one wonders, well, I mean, I, you know, one has to wonder, was it really wise to intervene at all? In the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, he was acquitted because fortunately there were independent journalists on the ground who recorded the videos.
Yeah.
I suspect that a different outcome would have happened if the videos yes. weren't there to exonerate.
No question.
Them, right. So, I think, I think it's probably a bit too, I think it's naive for individual citizens to think that they can go up against the state, in the face of, let's say, injustice, and think that they can come out okay. You end up often actually quite martyring yourself in prison or something else. And so, yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, are you bringing up these examples to sort of, in a way, I guess you're playing a little bit of devil's advocate, right? In trying to maybe get a better understanding of the Antifa perspective, because.
No, this is my perspective because I think what you are advocating for is does not port to reality. I think the idea of what we're taught of the state being is not at all played out in how the state acts, and we've seen this overwhelmingly in the last few years. Very, very easy example is we were all mandated to stay in our homes, right? And then we were basically commanded to go out and protest and told that you're not going to get this deadly disease, even though we're shoulder to shoulder. And it seems very clear that in certain, like in certain blue cities, this is one of the reasons I left Brooklyn, is it is much more dangerous for me to defend myself and my property than to aggress against someone who has something that I want. And this asymmetry is something that I don't see how you resolve through discourse.
Well, I mean, the reality of the politics in places like New York City or Portland, where I'm from, or many, many left-wing dominated cities in America, is you see, yes, tyranny and amoral legislation that is signed in, and a opposition that is in a minority that has really no political power.
Right.
And but that's that's this is what federalism is, right? It's just different states, different jurisdictions, different counties, all going to reflect the politics of the people who are involved. And I think this doesn't necessarily mean that one should throw out the baby with the bathwater and say the whole system doesn't work. I think there are many, many shortcomings of any governmental system, but I think liberal democracy broadly, as we have it in the West, I think is in my opinion, one of the best forms of government when it's working properly. And often it doesn't. And you can point to many examples in many jurisdictions. I write almost, I mean, every day I report on
Right,
about
right.
things happening in Portland, about how you can have on paper, First Amendment, Second Amendment, things like that, as part of applies to places like Portland, but the reality on the ground is very, very much different.
Right.
I think the responsibility of the American citizen then is to get involved in local politics. Citizens tend to kind of not really care about politics unless it's maybe a presidential election every 4 years, and then you turn. I'm not referring to you specifically, I mean, in general, the person turns a blind eye to what's happening at the scoreboard, at city council. And then you look, and then now all of us are kind of surprised that there are all these sexual propaganda stuff in the state-funded schools. It's just, it happens because of the lack of engagement actually in the political system. I don't think it's because the system is a failure. It's rather that one side has been not participating enough in informing the public about what's happening.
But let's just talk about these things with like so-called trans kids, right? We're hearing a lot of cases, especially in Canada, where you have, a couple got divorced and the mom has decided that their kid's trans, and the dad, who is like, it's just my son's a sissy or my daughter's a tomboy. It's basically like not only is he just completely regarded as a pariah, he's often threatened with jail or some other, loss of custody. I mean, it's not like you have a right to your opinion. If you're a dad in Portland, or if you're a dad like that in, California, I don't, and this is happening right now. This isn't just theoretical, right? Like, I don't know what I would tell that dad. I don't think like just try to inform people is enough. I think in cases like that, if this was my kid, I would start considering taking them to another country, and I wouldn't think twice about it.
So in Washington State, it was actually just days ago that the Democrat governor, Jay Inslee, signed into legislation a so-called gender-affirming bill that protects shelters from having from not informing parents and guardians of children who run away from anywhere in the U.S. And it's being billed in terms of the messaging and the PR around the now laws that it protects transgender youth.
Can I get this straight? If I'm understanding you correctly, my kid in Oklahoma flees to Washington State. Mm-hmm. According to the law, and holds up in some shelter there, they are not required, or they're required not to inform the parents back in Oklahoma?
If the child makes allegation that the home environment was not gender affirming, the shelter will no longer by law be required to inform the parent or guardian that they have custody of the child. That's correct.
Holy crap. Are they allowed to? Is it up to them, or is it like they're mandated not to? Because I know in California, for example, if you're a therapist, it is illegal. You're going to lose your license. If you have someone who's questioning their gender, having issues with, you know, gender conforming, which is a big spectrum, if you are trying to push them away to be like, hey, maybe this is a phase, maybe just, you know, you're going to lose your license. You have to be encouraging them to transition. So in Washington, are they allowed to tell the Oklahoma parents, or are they forbidden, or is it up to them?
It's my understanding that the licensed shelters have the ability to make that decision themselves.
Okay.
So the critics of this call it a law that would essentially protect child trafficking or child kidnapping.
Yes, of course.
So I bring this up as, you know, to I guess to support this perspective that you're putting forth, that there are a lot of really unjust laws in various parts of the United States. On an individual level, a family or an individual can move to another jurisdiction where they feel like laws are more just. It sounds like you made that decision yourself when you choose to live, chose to leave New York City to move to Texas. Maybe it comes from the fact that I come from, my parents were refugees from a country where there is no rule of law, and it's a one-party state. My parents escaped communism from Vietnam after experiencing prison camp after the fall of Saigon. And so with that history, and also just, you know, how, I mean, many states in the world are failed states where they have no functioning government. And the only way that people who live in these areas can have justice is to take up arms themselves against other people who they feel may wrong them in killings. And it's just, you know, I think as amoral, immoral a state may act, I think it's also foolish to think that the alternate, which would be let's say to get rid of a government altogether. I mean, there's just so many examples of places where there is complete absence of government and things completely go to it becomes an S word hole, essentially, because those who gain power are those who are the most violent and are able to amass support, tacit or whatever, through the use of violence or through the use of threat of violence. They're warlords and warlords that exist in places where there's an absence of government. I'm thinking of, you know, in various parts of Africa. So, wow, I didn't think I would get into like a political philosophy debate with you.
Well, I was born in the Soviet Union, so I mean, we kind of have a shared biography, although it's very clear that when I left the Soviet Union, and, you know, obviously I was too young to remember it, but it was a much better place than Vietnam was at the time. That's not even a question. There was no real threat that my parents are going to go to some camp or that, you know, they were going to be victims of political violence to the extent that your parents had to worry about. So there's a Venn diagram here.
Well, revolutions are usually extremely violent, and they bring in a lot of instability and uncertainty. And I just, you know, there are a lot of young people who live in stable societies who have all these ideas about how much society could be better if only there was a revolution and there was a regime change. And they don't think about all the uncertainties that come out after that. I mean, you know, for my mother's parents, she came from a middle-class family, so they had the resources to actually leave before the fall of Saigon. But my grandfather, who owned land and business, was thinking, for many months, the communist forces from the north were making their way down south.
Yeah.
Both my parents are from the south, but my maternal grandfather was just thinking, look, you know, maybe things won't be really that bad. We'll have a new government, but they made all these promises about, you know, they're not going to carry out retribution against the citizens of South Vietnam.
Right, yeah.
Let's stay and see. You know, we have business, we have family here, our lives are here. This is all we know. Why go somewhere else? And then, all their property was confiscated and they were thrown into labor camps. And, you know, so it's just, this is kind of also the foolishness that I see with, you know, let's say some of the good faith actors of the Antifa side. They really thought, for example, when they established CHAZ, which was that Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle in 2020,
right.
I went there. When they forced police out and then created this hard border in the middle of a major city in America, they thought, look, we can have our own system of direct democracy. We don't have to rely on the racist Seattle government or the U.S. government. We can take care of ourselves. And to refresh the audience, you may remember the pictures and videos that came out. You know, they tried to do their own agriculture, and it was these plants that they bought from a local Kroger affiliate, and they put it, you know, on soil on top of cardboard. They couldn't grow anything. They had no food, essentially for 3 weeks. This is the funny part, you know, that it was essentially a massive welfare state in that they had all these resources that were transported in from outside the autonomous zone. The water, the food, the money was being brought in, and they were unable to do anything with it. What it led to was infighting, shootings, and murders, and vandalism and property destruction. So it was, you know, this is, I wrote in my book, if you want to see what Antifa's ideology realized in the real world, look to CHAZ, or you can even look to RAZ. In Portland, there was a Red House autonomous zone occupation that happened at the end of 2020, styled after CHAZ. And these are S-word holes, you know, all of them. And so I just, that's my, you know, I want people to realize that it's not the utopianism of particularly the Antifa ideology is, it's a fantasy, and it leads to people dying, particularly Black and brown people. You know, having a political discussion about anarchist political philosophy is really entirely different thing from what I report on. I only kind of touch on it just because Antifa claim to be radical anarchists. But as you've probably observed, quite often in many jurisdictions, the power of the state, of the American state, is completely in line with their agenda. Antifa love it when left-wing prosecutors or corrupt prosecutions go after their political enemies. They love it. They celebrate it. So, you know, these are all, you know, they're filled with, you know, it's a hypocritical movement as well. But
But I mean, one of the reasons, because the subtitle of your book is Antifa's Radical Plan is it Destroy, Dismantle, Destroy Democracy. I have never heard a good argument, and I've only heard a few bad arguments, why I should give two craps about Karen's opinion about how I should live my life or what I should do with my property, my money, which is the basis of democracy. It makes no sense to me. And maybe the argument could be that it has a positive result, but it seems that in its just essential nature, it's fallacious and fraudulent.
Yeah, I understand that perspective. There's a lot of people who are the libertarian traditions who have the views that you do about why should other people be able to vote in lawmakers who have a philosophy about really big government intervention.
Or Chesa Boudin, even. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a good response to that. I'm not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing, really. It's you know, what I write about and report on is political extremism. And I think, personally, I believe the role of the state is really important, particularly around public safety and things like that. And then when you have violent extremist elements within the American body politic advocating for the dismantling of law enforcement and offering up other alternatives that have been tested to various degrees to massive failure. And the response from these ideologues is, well, we haven't tried it enough. You know, it's like, right. We haven't done the full prison abolitionism. We haven't done the full defunding of police. There was, you know, pulling back the funds, but the police were refunded in all these places anyway. So we need to just keep trying harder. And I mean, how many people need to die, you know, in this type of project? You know, a lot of the Antifa look to places like Rojava, which is also known as Kurdistan. It's this autonomous region carved out of Syria, where mostly ethnic Kurds have created what they call an autonomous zone, where they do direct democracy modeled on libertarian socialist worldview and things. And it's like, well, they're able to have that because Syria is a failed state. And so in Iraq, under at least when during the Islamic State insurgencies, was essentially a failed state or failing state as well. So and millions of people died in the conflicts since the Arab Spring. So I just urge sort of like caution for the philosophers who kind of, they have an ideal about how society could be better, and they don't really think about particularly all the historical examples of attempts to achieve these things have resulted in mass famine, death, destruction of civilization.
Let's talk a bit about your recent work with all this Drag Queen Story Hour. I saw someone on Twitter very recently made the point, it's like, how come you don't have like drag queens reading to senior citizens or reading to, you know, Vietnam vets, like vets of any kind, you know, people who are maybe lonely or someone in the hospital? They're specifically going after children. I had James Lindsay on my show several months ago, and he discussed how the progenitor of this whole movement was to specifically talk about targeting children and giving them queer spaces and things like this. At the same time, the corporate press would like to pretend that it's all entirely innocuous, and this is just some kind of weird homophobia, transphobia. People are pushing back about it. There are complete lies that in many states they're trying to ban drag altogether. Whereas my position, and I'm sure you agree with it, it makes no sense if you had Chippendales Story Hour or Stripper Story Hour. These are adult entertainment art forms, and people go to these clubs at night. They get drunk. They have a rowdy time. It's a lot of it's outrageous and risque, and it is what it is, and let adults have their fun while you're bringing kids into this. So can you talk about what you've seen firsthand at these events and how it's been misreported, if it has, by the corporate press and in social media?
I started reporting a lot on radical trans ideology, and that, that now is connected to all these drag events because quite often there's a nexus to Antifa.
Oh, okay.
As parents have become concerned about some of these events because of safeguarding issues, and these are legitimate concerns. You have usually adult men performing sexualized dance routines in front of the presence of minors and children, sometimes very young children, or even during the drag queen reading events. These are men dressed in provocative sexualized outfits, and it's legitimate to have questions about how the performers, if they're vetted at all, and almost usually they never are. I just did a report out of Washington State in the Seattle area of a an all ages Mother's Day themed drag event where children were in presence, and the performances is basically what you would see at a strip club, but by
Yeah.
drag people, the gyrating and all that. I contacted the business owner to ask if they vet the performers. I haven't heard back. But usually the businesses and organizers never vet. They don't do background checks. And that's a safeguarding issue because adults who have access to children need to be fully vetted. And on another level, you have to wonder, like, why such this insistence on and having an audience of children when drag in the gay community it's adult entertainment. It's done in gay clubs. The jokes are really sexual. The dance moves are sexual. The nudity, all of it. It's adult entertainment, And I'm speaking to you as a gay man. I think that I'm probably gonna get a lot of pushback for this, but in the 90s and 2000s, when gay rights campaigners were really pushing for the protection of gay rights in American law, let's say with same-sex marriage, etc., those who opposed gay rights often put out a talking point that this is an attempt to brainwash children into being homosexuals. And that was all completely BS. Really, sexual orientation is something that is, and this is through the social science research and psychology research for decades, it's basically unchangeable. And so, but I wonder if these arguments about the targeting of children to recruit them, if it actually really applies to the trans agenda, which is entirely in a way in conflict with the goals of the gay and lesbian rights movement. Gay and lesbian activists traditionally argued that their sexualities was an innate, unchangeable part of who they are. In fact, I'm speaking for myself. I mean, this is all what we know now. From a very young age, you're a bit different. Once you start going to puberty and developing feelings and interests, you know that you're homosexual, and that remains with you for the rest of your life. But what the trans ideologues argue is that there is no such thing as sex. By that, I mean gender. That it's entirely constructed and that it's meaningless. You can be a man one day, you can be a woman the next moment, you can be non-binary, you can be completely a neo-gender. It's whoever you want to be at any time, and you can change back and forth. That is essentially the trans ideology in part. And that is at complete odds with, well, the claim for the protections of the rights of gays and lesbians, which is that sex is innate and our orientation as same-sex attracted individuals is unchangeable. Then when you have another ideology that says actually sex is meaningless anyways, it's at odds. But even though it's at odds, the entire establishment, legacy, LGBTQ rights groups have intentionally merged all of this together to the point that, you can have a gay man like me or trans people who speak out against the trans ideology, we're called anti-LGBT. The legislation in various states aimed at protecting children from irreversible medical transitioning, that those bills are called anti-LGBT. It's all, it's a farce. It's just it's a messaging PR strategy that's been unfortunately really effective. And I think what's really particularly scary is that people who are organizing at the grassroots level to try to inform the public about some of these things that are happening at some of these all ages drag shows. Well, they are often subjected to violence by Antifa and other far left extremists who show up, threaten violence, use pepper spray, and threaten to kill people. You can see the messaging of the trans ideologues in a lot of their shirts and signs: "Trans rights or else." And then there are pictures of firearms and rifles. So that's not even particularly subtle. "Protect trans kids," and there's a knife. The treatment of the mass shooter in Nashville, the transgender mass shooter, that shooter, the mass murderer who killed children at a school, was treated by many trans activists and trans groups as one of the victims. So, this is sort of their worldview, what we're up against, and they're not interested in discourse. They're interested in using threats and promises of violence to try to get people to shut up. And you've seen, whenever they engage in their acts of intimidation, it's never treated by the left as a problem. When you have right-wing people protesting in various Capitol buildings, that was called insurrections. When you have the same actions committed by far-left extremists, coupled with actually injuries of law enforcement, that's just seen as people engaging in their First Amendment rights, protesting against their government. So, I don't have to tell you or your audience about how corrupt media is and how effective they are through narrative and propaganda messaging. And so it's, I'm thankful that there are influential podcasters like you who are able to better inform people about what's happening.
But let me, if I can ask a personal question, you don't have to answer if you want. My high school is half Asian, and growing up gay would have not been acceptable to any of those parents. Did you have a uncomfortable coming out story? Are you, is, or we can move on to the next question if I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I can talk about this. I'm glad you asked. So, most East Asian societies are actually quite conservative when it comes to things around sex and sexuality. It's tied into a pretty long tradition of Confucianism. And so, the sort of don't ask, don't tell attitudes around sex and homosexuality, it's different than, let's say, the white American hesitancies around that, because it's usually not tied to Christianity. Yeah, it's just about having more, like, modesty is really a virtue of East Asian societies. So, being publicly out about your sexuality is just seen as sort of it's like immodest. And for me personally, I came out to my family actually rather late. I was in my I was like maybe 27 or something, and I didn't give my my mother more credit than she deserved. When I was growing up, I was the typical sissy gay boy. So I was really into Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, the bubblegum pop. Any I played with my sister's dolls when I was younger. Most parent, most, let's say, American families, when they know if they notice that in a boy, they would notice that that's not typical boy behavior. I think for my parents, because they were recent immigrants, they weren't really quite, they didn't really know what was, what type of music boys or girls listen to, what type of toys American boys or girls play with. So they didn't really catch on. But actually, by my mid-20s, I think what me and my mother noticed finally wasn't actually about my interests and how they were more female typical, but that I had never brought home a young woman ever. And when I was nearing 30, she finally caught on. She asked me one day, and
Oh, she asked you. Oh, wow. Okay.
She took it really well, I think. Attitudes around homosexuality has also changed very rapidly in East Asia, as it has in the West. It's not quite to the same level, but they're much more open about it now. And just years, not even that long ago, just a number of years ago, homosexuality was still really kind of seen as a psychopathy, at some, not psychopathy, a psychiatric condition. And was treated as such, particularly in Vietnam. That's not the case anymore as of recent, but I think I wouldn't have changed my upbringing. I think East Asian values around modesty and hard work are really important, and it leads to good decision making when that's instilled as a value into the children and the next generation. And you can see in the data that East Asians, wherever they immigrate to in the West, do economically, academically very, very well. And it's because of the various values of a merit-based society, and also not being narcissistic about who or what you do and who you are. It's about putting in the hard work.
I'll tell you an anecdote, then I have a question. When I was in North Korea, I asked my guide about homosexuality, and she very cheerfully said, "We don't have that here." And I've watched this video once of a Canadian reporter, and he had returned to North Korea, and he was talking to his guides outside the ostrich ranch, which is near Pyongyang, the capital city. And he goes to them, he goes, "Oh, the last time I was here, I was talking to you guys about gays and lesbian." And the male guide, who was like in his 50s, like, Yeah, we know. He goes, "Well, do you guys have bisexuality?" And this poor North Korean guy just looks at him and it's like, "What?" And it was just like he was at a point. He's like, "Are you just making things up just to screw with us because we're North Korean and we don't know about the outside world?" But my question to you is, do you ever, if that was how you were as a little boy, do you ever stop and think that if your mom had been a white liberal, that you'd be Andrea right now or whatever name, and you'd be in a dress?
Yes, I think about that all the time, and it's really painful to me when I see these stories of families being celebrated, of where what they have is a child, a boy who's essentially a sissy boy, who's been raised in an environment where the child is introduced to trans ideologies, encouraged down that path through puberty blockers, and later through medical transitioning. We know through the medical literature, that, and this is repeated quite often, that most children who have gender dysphoria don't deal with those feelings anymore once they go through puberty. And in fact, a majority of them will end up being homosexual. And so, but again, this is how trans ideology really is in opposition, I think, to gay rights, or even the rights of children who have same-sex attraction, minors who, teens who have those feelings. It's like, instead of just allowing them to be the boy or girl, however they manifest themselves, they're being encouraged to actually change, until physically change their bodies into something else. And that's, it's really actually bizarre that that's being encouraged as like a beautiful thing, that that's being authentic to oneself. You're not being authentic to yourself if you have to alter yourself through hormones and medical surgeries, changing health, taking away healthy body parts, inverting healthy body parts, introducing, a lifelong dependence on cross-sex hormones and potentially many, many surgeries to be your authentic self. This is it's so interesting how so many things that leftists sell us on, it's actually really the complete opposite in reality.
It's also something that I don't think is discussed anywhere near enough is the effect of hormones on the human psyche, because it's very widely known that if a woman is pregnant, watch out, she's crying one minute, screaming the next, laughing the next. It's very, very common. When males take testosterone or steroids, it's very correlated with aggression and, muscle growth, those other things. But just the psychology is certainly there. Like someone who's got high testosterone, he's looking for a fight. And there's never this question that, like, well, what happens when you give a child or a minor or even a young adult, these hormones, and what effect it, if someone has already dealing with suicidal ideation or depression or mental illness, and you add hormones to the mix, the idea that it's automatically going to move that individual into a positive direction and it's never going to make them even more spiral even harder is not discussed at all, even as a hypothesis. And that to me is because the surgery isn't universal, but the hormone use is much more common, much more easy to access. And that is like a step one issue that we're not even getting to the stuff downstairs or the removing of the double mastectomies.
Yeah, I wonder, I have to look into the literature on this, but I wonder if the introduction of all these different hormones may correlate also with maybe more of an increased propensity towards violent outbursts
Oh,
in
yeah.
some extreme examples, because you may have seen that in 2020, I was posting the mugshots of the riot suspects in all these different cities, particularly Portland, because that's where I'm from, and that's where we had the longest Antifa riots in 2020. We had 120 nights every day, nonstop. And so I have this data set of 1,000 arrestees. And what I was seeing is that there's this disproportionate representation of gender diverse people, who, men and women, who are clearly on cross-sex hormones and are trans in some way. And that's it's well it tells well for one thing that it tells me is that a lot of transgender people are being drawn into political radicalization.
Yes.
And in fact, there was a study out of Quebec, Canada, that found that transgender people are particularly vulnerable to violent radicalization. And I wonder how, the use of hormones makes, let's say, these young women more willing to engage in violent confrontation. And then, of course, the trans woman, by that I mean biological males who are now identifying as women, they're being violent in a way that's also still typically male typical as well. And so, and of course, the ideology of Antifa on the far left encourages violent confrontations as well. What did they say? Respect my resistance or respect my existence or expect resistance. They have all these chants about justifying these sort of militant confrontations around the trans ideology. So it's a really volatile situation. You have organized groups of violent individuals who are quite often trying to recruit transgender people. You have vulnerable people with psychiatric comorbidities being on various hormones. And then you have an environment where the mainstream left-wing society encourages militant direct action for the cause of trans rights.
You aren't a huge dude, to put it mildly. So when you are, and you've kind of got a known face in certain circumstances, certain circles. I mean, how do you handle that fear of being physically, 'cause, and you have been physically assaulted on more than one occasion. Like, how do you handle that kind of like, oh, holy crap, am I gonna get spotted? And is someone gonna, feel the need to like make their name by taking by doing something to me?
So I first started covering Antifa all the way back in late 2016. In November 2016, when Trump was announced as the surprise winner of that election, in Portland, we had 3 days of rioting. I was working at a student paper at that time for at Portland State University. I went out. I was assigned with covering the protests that night, and at that time, it was hugely shocking to me to see really large groups of organized rioters in the same black uniforms with their faces covered in black, with weapons ready and very effective at destroying whole streets within really seconds, actually. Of course, that scenes like that ended up becoming a banality in
Right.
Portland going forward. There were lots of really violent riots involving Antifa, 2017, 2018, 2019. And I kept going out. I was unknown really at that time. I had a very small Twitter following, but I was going out recording video just on my iPhone, all in public, all lawful First Amendment activities. And I noticed that, well, it was from very, very early on, the coverage in the press was to call these violent extremists anti-fascist protesters who were protesting against racism. And if there was any reference of violence in the legacy media reporting, it would kind of be brushed over and framed within sort of a like violence occurred at
Right, yes.
this
Passive
racial
voice.
justice protest, So I thought, that's why I went with my video phones. I thought, let the video speak for themselves. I'm not interested in being a pundit or commentator. I don't, go on YouTube and make videos talking about what happened. I'll just record the videos. I did that. I put it on Twitter. I started writing some columns about what was happening. I wrote a few pieces for the Wall Street Journal, and then that eventually made me a target. But I kept going out. I was very naive at that time. I just thought, look, they're gonna yell at me, curse at me. They've been doing that, but I'm just gonna keep going. I don't talk to anyone. I'm a very passive person. I'm short. It's like, who's gonna, get violent with me? It's like, really, you're gonna beat up some Asian guy who just has his phone out on the street? Well, I was naive in 2019. That's exactly what they did, and they just kept escalating and escalating. And then eventually with Antifa, Rose City Antifa, which is the Portland cell, they made me like their enemy number one. And so they've showed up at my family's home. They've issued many, many death threats against me that I view as credible, that I've had to refer to law enforcement.
There's fatwas.
I've Yes. And actually, I'm really glad you bring up that word, because oftentimes people are it's difficult to kind of understand how Antifa are organized, but you can think of them as analogous, I think, to the jihadist
Yeah.
ideology. You can have official groups like Islamic State, like Al-Qaeda, like Boko Haram, but you can also have just the ideology and the propaganda put out into the ether, and then a call for violence in various radicalized individuals who have never traveled to the Middle East. Take up a car for a car ramming, as they've done in Europe and in the US many, many times. They take up a knife, they take up a handgun or a rifle, and commit atrocities without having actually any direct linkage to a centralized cell or group. And so you can think of Antifa like that. So, yes, they are ideology, but they're also, it's a movement, it's a group, they're gangs, they're cells, and they're also radicalized individuals. And they're really dangerous. And I think just because you're not seeing them rioting on the street every night like they did in 2020 doesn't make them a threat. The threat, I think, the main threat they do is to normalize, to chip away at this American norm of discourse and First Amendment as sort of a value that we all share. They're chipping at the legitimacy of that. And they've been aided by a lot of Democrats who unfortunately have questioned if the First Amendment is still relevant today. We need to really limit speech because there's too much hate speech, there's too much disinformation, the First Amendment allows too much. And you work on this long and hard enough, you'll eventually get the legislation to change. I don't see it happening anytime soon because of, fortunately, how robust our constitution is and how difficult it is to change. But we have seen in various countries and in the West, particularly in Europe, in Australia and New Zealand, where they can just very easily pass legislation to ban speech after very effective campaigns at chipping away free speech as a cultural norm. Yeah, for a law to have legitimacy, it has to be a cultural norm.
But I mean, you just to circle back to the question, how do you handle just being afraid? I mean, are you just like nutting up, or is it like, you know, just you have this kind of a Calvinist sense of destiny?
Well, after my mob beating in June 2019, that's the one where they punched me repeatedly in the head and face, and then they threw all the milkshakes on me. Those were lots of pictures that were taken at the time that went viral. I had a subarachnoid hemorrhage from that, which is bleeding the brain, so I nearly died in the hospital. I was very lucky to recover from that mostly. It took about 6 months of medical treatment and therapies in the hospital. But then I changed my tactics. I thought, look, everything I was witnessing for years now, I need to write about it in a book, but I still need to be on the ground, so I'll be undercover. In 2020, when rioting happened after George Floyd died, there were so many people going out on the streets that I was able to blend in undercover because there was just too many people for Antifa to really keep eye on everyone. And I kept going. And for months, that was okay. But in 2021, May Day of 2021, I was undercover again on the streets. And there was maybe 50 to 100 people. And no, it wasn't May Day, sorry. It was the 1 year anniversary of George Floyd's death. That's what it was. Or it was 1 year anniversary of the riot. It was an anniversary for something significant for Antifa in Portland. I went undercover and I was, unfortunately, they became suspicious because I wasn't confronting police with them. I wasn't throwing stuff at the police station, and there was, you know, just several dozen people, so they were able to go up and question me, and they pulled off my mask and chased me through downtown. I had to take refuge in a hotel. They had beat me before I ran in the hotel. I was pretty badly injured again. And so my goal is not to be a martyr. I'm not this dumb person to just keep going out to like get injured. I've had to really change how I do my reporting, and it's a really sad reality. You know, I do primarily writing now. You probably, people will notice, you know, I don't really post videos that I record very much anymore because I'm not able to do it. I've become such a big target to not just Antifa, leftists in general, that it has made citizen video journalism for me essentially impossible, which has been really sad and disappointing, but you know, a reality of what it means to be somebody who's disruptive in some way in America. You know, I've had to learn different skills and focus on different things. You know, I do a lot of crime reporting in writing now, and I think that reporting has illuminated a lot of very important stories, and I'm still able to do important work without necessarily putting myself at physical risk by being on the ground. I really miss being out there. Unfortunately, I cannot. And so, you know, I guess in one way, the violent extremists of Antifa have won. You know, their goal was to drive me away from being out in public, which they've succeeded in. But they haven't silenced me, because I still write and I still speak.
Andy, we're running out of time. What has been your favorite part of this interview?
I think this is the first time that I've engaged in a substantial discussion about political philosophy. I think that's different, and it's, you know, it challenges me to think about different things. I think to think about these subjects differently is what I mean. So, you know, I thank you for asking me these different questions and going more philosophical and giving me an opportunity to answer.
You are welcome.